This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Katkin for Jane Lindholm. The Olympic decathlon champion Americans have known for years as Bruce Jenner told ABC's Diane Sawyer in a recent interview that he was tired of living a lie, and transitioning into a woman at age 65 meant he could finally be himself. Today on Vermont Edition, we wanted to talk with transgender Vermonters about their experiences, the fear and uncertainty, the challenges, and the bright spots of support and acceptance they've encountered. 18-year-old Xander Long just graduated from Burlington High School and will go to Harvard next fall. Xander came out at a young age as transgender and has been involved in queer and trans advocacy and education in schools throughout Vermont. Xander's also worked as a youth board member, peer educator, and facilitator at Outright Vermont, a nonprofit that works to protect the rights of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Vermonters. Xander Long, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. I'm also joined in the studio by Gabriella Netsch, longtime former Rutland area teacher and principal. She now owns a business teaching people how to drive. She's the parent of two children and went public with her decision to become a woman in 2012. Gabriella Netsch, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having.
So, Gabriella, let me start with you. You spent the majority of your life as Gary. As a man, you were married, you had kids. So how old were you when you first realized that being Gary, being a boy, didn't feel right?
Nina, my story really starts when I was about 5 years old. I remember going to a carnival with my dad and two sisters back in the 50s. And before you figure out how old I am, I'll give you enough clues here so that you can figure it out. But I remember that my sisters wanted a teddy bear pin, and I remember I wanted one too. And I remember that probably wasn't – I remember my dad saying, no, you really shouldn't – boys really shouldn't have that. Of course, in today's day, I think we'd probably just do that. But this was 1957. I was 5 years old. When I was 10, it was in 1962, right around the Cuban Missile Crisis, I remember – going to bed at night and saying nighttime prayers and saying, I think I'm supposed to be a girl. But remember, it's 1962. President Kennedy is the president. And, you know, boys are boys and girls are girls. And there wasn't any blending.
How isolating was that?
Well, it was isolating in a lot of ways. And yet, I didn't really know. I didn't really know what it was, because there wasn't any internet. There wasn't anything to do with people who were in different genders. Was a sort of a subculture kind of thing, you know, and it wasn't, I just didn't know. I truly didn't know. I used to experiment when I was in my teens, and I knew that I had this, I figured I just must be really weird, you know. But I just closed the closet door, as many folks, you know, did over the time, so.
Xander, I want to ask you, same question, when did you first realize something was off?
I think my experience with gender has really been fluid through the years. I think I can definitely look backwards and narrate what might be a trans narrative. I look back to being a young child, and I remember I was really a tomboy. I never wanted to play with girls or that sort of thing, but I don't think I really understood how gender played a role in my life and how I felt about my own gender until I moved to Vermont. And I started going to high school, and I went to my high school's Gay Straight Alliance and heard the word transgender for one of the first times. And I think that as soon as I heard that word and realized that, oh, people have different feelings about gender. Gender is not this sort of thing that is fixed and impermeable. It is something that can be fluid. So I think that's the time.
Well, and I want to ask you, you identify yourself as transmasculine. Maybe you can explain what that means.
So I think that there are a lot of different words for gender now that as we sort of begin to understand gender as something that is more than just what our bodies look like. And for me, transmasculine means that I identify masculinely. I don't identify 100% as a boy. Pretty uncomfortable identifying 100% as a boy, but I know that I'm not a girl. And so it just, transmasculine means that I don't identify with the gender I was assigned at birth, and I identify myself as masculine, but not binarily.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about what it means to be transgender in Vermont, how it feels to realize that the gender you were assigned at birth may be wrong, and where to go from there. We'd love to get your thoughts on this issue. Have you been through this? Do you know someone who's transitioned from one gender to the other? What's it been like? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Gabriella, you were talking about how you grew up in the 60s. There was no internet, a very different environment. How did you finally realize that you were not the only one, that there were others that shared this?
At the beginning of the show, you talked about me being pre-internet, and that was really an important point because it was when the internet came around. I began to realize I could see that I wasn't alone at this. I began to connect with folks in ways that were just very anonymous, but I was able to get information that helped me understand that it wasn't something that was just out there. There were other people like that. So I sought counseling. I got good counseling. The important thing that I wanted to be is just to be normal. That's all I ever really wanted to be. And it was when a therapist said to me, yeah, Gabby, you are normal, that it kind of just sort of opened some doors for me. And I'm not as versed in all the terms of the younger generation. There are many, many more of those. I'm really much more comfortable just being trans woman and identify that way sort of all of my life now. I work that way. I present that way. My markers are that way. All of those things have changed.
In the recent interview that Caitlyn Jenner gave, she talked, I think she answered the question, why did you wait until you were 65 to make the transition? And her answer was, I couldn't live like this anymore. I couldn't live a lie. And so I'm wondering, Gabriella, did you feel the whole first 50, 60 years of your life that you were living a lie?
Well, I wasn't living a full truth. I was living a full life. I had a wonderful life. I was inwardly depressed, and I wasn't living up to my full potential. And I knew that. I knew it inside. I knew someday that I needed to deal with this. I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. But I knew at some point, I knew this all of my life. It was something that I was reminded of inwardly every single day. It would just never go away. I would say I would like it to just go away. But it wouldn't go away. When you are transgender, one thing Caitlyn Jenner said something about, you don't make this gender change for a reality TV show. I'll tell you, you don't do these things. You don't go through the processes that you have to go through unless it's something that you can't not live without. I was thought about not being around many times in my life, and I realized that sort of higher rate of suicide was affecting me, and so I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I was just sick of having lies. I was sick of not being truly authentic. And that's partly why I want to be here, because I really want, I want others to feel of my age group, that being authentic is really. My transition was as much about becoming a woman as it was becoming just who I am, just becoming authentic. I wasn't
true to yourself.
Really true to myself. I wasn't looking to have a 20-year-old body. My sister once said, "Why do you want to be a 60-year-old woman? You get the pantsuits." I have one other point that I would like to make for folks, and that is many times people will who I've known will say, well, as long as you're happy, that's a famous line for lots of folks in that. And I respond to them and say, it's really not about being happy. Are you happy all the time? You're not happy all the time. I'm not happy all the time. The problems don't go away. I use the word I'm at peace. I'm just settled about what I am and what I need to do.
Sander, you talked about how it wasn't until you moved to Vermont and went to high school and reached out to youth groups that you started to feel perhaps more at peace or had some questions answered. You've done a lot of peer mentoring and have worked a lot with Outright Vermont. What's it like for middle and high school individuals in Vermont that are going through this? How difficult a situation is it? Was it for you and other teens that you've talked to?
So I really can speak only to my experience and then what others have told me. I think I'm really lucky to live in Chittenden County. I actually ended up moving away, and then we moved back because Chittenden County was the place to be for supportive care, for supportive peers, for supportive mentors. And so I've been really lucky to have had a very supportive peer group, a very supportive school. People were always willing to use the right pronouns, to use the right name. It's part of some classroom practices in Chittenden County to ask for pronouns, which I think is really wonderful. But through Outright, I have connected with students who are not in Chittenden County, and I think that that story looks a lot different. I think that we've seen a number of schools just now asking for support and asking for training to support their trans students, to support their lesbian and gay and bisexual students. I think that the services that exist in Burlington really haven't yet quite grown to Chittenden or outside of Chittenden County, and I think the story looks a lot different for people out in more rural areas.
I'd like to bring another voice into the discussion now. That's Dr. Rachel Inker. She runs the Transgender Clinic in Burlington and has been taking care of a number of transgender men and women. She also runs a transgender youth clinic on Pearl Street in Burlington. Dr. Inker, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much.
So PBS ran a recent documentary on its Frontline program called Growing Up Trans that chronicles the life of young kids who identify as transgender, and the kids and their family and their families, rather, have to make unbelievably difficult choices that could affect them the rest of their lives. Let's give a listen to one of the teens profiled in that program.
My name is Arielle. I am 13 years old and I identify as a girl. I haven't really experienced puberty at all. I mean, the hormone blockers are like my lifesaver. But me turning into a man is just probably the most horrifying thing ever I could ever think of in the farthest reaches of my mind is me not going on the hormone blockers anymore and me developing into a man. That would just be horrible.
That's from a Frontline program called Growing Up Trans. Dr. Inker, are you seeing younger patients like Ariel? And how do you help them and their families decide whether or not to go forward with treatment?
Sure. I think, as Xander points out, many adolescents and children and families are becoming more and more educated about options and possibilities, and that's provided a tremendous amount of relief to know that care is accessible. In our community, for mid-adolescents and older teens, there's the opportunity to begin hormone treatment, and for younger children and early teens, there's an opportunity to begin pubertal blockade or medications that the young girl just discussed. And for those younger children and early teens, they are seen at the University of Vermont with a pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Martina Kotcher, who provides that care. And mid and older teens can come to see me at the Community Health Center of Burlington's clinic.
And the puberty blockers you just referenced, those are basically sort of a pause button, medications that young teens can take to hold off puberty. And that's right. Is it basically just to give them a few more years to figure out if they want to go forward and transition to the opposite gender?
It is. So it allows a pause, which is very important, but it also allows what she described, avoiding the going through puberty, which can be quite traumatic for trans children and adolescents. And also allows for later transition, if that's what they decide, to be more effective.
So have you ever encountered someone who is, say, at 12, thinking they might want to transition, change genders, who then changed their mind at 15 or 16 and decided against that? Because I think that might be every family's nightmare, that a young child that thinks they want to change then changes their mind.
I think that's an ongoing concern, not just for families of younger children, but also families of mid and older teens, of young adults. it's something that people are very concerned about. I think that's what pubertal blockade allows. I think there's very good evidence that what is called gender dysphoria that persists into adolescence really reflects a desire to transition, rather than a much younger child who is more gender variant and is exploring different expressions of gender. So that, again, as you pointed out, is a nice pause where kids can continue to process and be followed, but also prevent pubertal change.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about being transgender in Vermont and all of the issues that surround that. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Time magazine called 2015 the transgender tipping point, which I think is very interesting. It's really gotten a lot of coverage. Dr. Inker, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions. Zoning in on the process, if someone walks into your office and says, I've wanted for years to be a man, or I've wanted for years to be a woman, like Gabriella has mentioned she went through, what's the first thing you do?
So the first thing we do is really spend time getting to know someone, hearing about their medical history, their experience in the world. We have a clinical social worker in our office that meets with people and discusses that process as well, any other mental health issues they have. So it's really a comprehensive assessment. Nobody walks in on the first day and begins hormone treatment, although people are often very eager and feel a tremendous sense of urgency. And then they go through a process of ongoing screening with physical exam and laboratory screening. And then after a certain number of visits, we usually begin.
And are the treatments and the surgeries needed to transition available in Vermont? And are they covered by insurance? I mean, how expensive is this?
Well, that's an excellent question. There's been tremendous progress and change in the state over the last couple of years. The state of Vermont, through their Medicaid programs, as well as people who have plans through Vermont Health Connect, have wonderful coverage, which includes hormone treatment, so medications, laboratory monitoring, office visits, and also surgery. And that's been a huge change and a source of hope for people. Their private insurers have been slower on the uptake. There is now an insurance mandate as of 2 years ago that mandates that private insurers, with a few exceptions, cover all transgender-related care. And that has slowly been happening. So I've seen a very dramatic change in the last 2 years.
And Gabriella, you were nodding at what Dr. Inker was mentioning. Mm-hmm. You wanted to comment?
Yeah, I had requested just to get information about the surgeries and if my insurance through teacher retirement would cover it. And without getting into all of the details, I will tell you that initially I was denied because it wasn't covered. And the law that Rachel speaks about works because it was very quickly resolved and it was very quickly changed. And so I am approved. I haven't chosen to do those things, but I am approved to do them.
We got an email that said, glad to see this getting coverage in Vermont. Thank you. I don't understand the hate that some people seem to have for those of us who are transgender. What happened to live and let live? And how have we harmed you? We just want to make our own way in life, not be persecuted, and be able to be happy. Sarah posted on Facebook, as we begin to understand the complexities of gender, I would let listeners know that one does not necessarily transition from, quote-unquote, one gender to the other, as there are multiple gender identities that a person might transition to or toward. For me, gender is a performance that I enact every day. What I would like to see is more folks embracing the fluidity that exists, both in how they respond to others and or within their own gender identity. Well, Dr. Inker, I really want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Rachel Inker runs the Transgender Clinic in Burlington and has been taking care of a number of transgender men and women. She also runs a transgender youth clinic on Pearl Street in Burlington. And we'll take more of your calls and continue this conversation after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. It's estimated that there are about 700,000 transgender adults in the country, and while 65% of Americans say they have a close friend or relative who's gay or lesbian, only about 9% of Americans know someone who is transgender. Thanks to reality television, social media, pop culture, transgender men and women are becoming much more outspoken. Today on Vermont Edition, we're talking with transgender Vermonters about their experiences, the ups as well as the downs. Listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic. You can call in at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition webpage at vpr.net. Let's go to the phones now and take a call from Callis. Let's talk with Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to share a little of my story. I'm a 32-year-old trans woman who was born and raised in Callis, and I moved to D.C. after college and transitioned while I was there, and then moved back to my hometown and have been here ever since. And it's really... When I first came back to Vermont, I had some difficulty finding doctors that would work with me. It was almost a year before I actually found Rachel and go to Burlington for stuff. And that was my biggest challenge in central Vermont, was finding good medical care there that was knowledgeable about my situation and the medications I needed.
Jamie, what about the reaction you've gotten from friends and neighbors in rural Vermont? Xander was talking about how nice it was for him being in Burlington and a place like Chittenden County. What's it like for you as a transgender woman in a smaller town?
It was absolutely a wonderful experience. I grew up here, so coming back, I knew pretty much everyone in town. I pretty quickly got a job at the little corner store and got to know everybody I didn't already know. And I really had absolutely no problems, no negative attitudes. I was very pleasantly surprised at how open and loving everybody in the community has been.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate that. Xander, you've talked about the fact that in Chittenden County, you feel that there's a little bit of a more progressive outlook. You felt supported. How about with your family? And have you had pushback that's been really difficult for you?
I've been really lucky with my family. They've been supportive throughout my transition. I think that as a young person, parents always struggle a little bit when they have a child who says, I feel uncomfortable, I don't feel well. Whether it's to do with gender or other circumstances in life, and certainly learning how to communicate about how I felt and how they could best support me was something that was important.
I was surprised to read how high the suicide attempt rate is among transgender teens. And what do you think, Xander, could be done to improve that?
I think that providing resources for young people and for families about where to go for support, how to support your child, how to find support among your peers. If you're in a place that's not safe, where to go outside of that place to find support. I think also creating more narratives. I think there's so many different ways to be trans. There's not one single homogenous narrative. And so I think opening up the stories of what does it mean to be trans? What does it mean to be gender nonconforming? And making those stories seen and visible to people so that they can find themselves in the world and other people, I think is really, really important.
Once again, listeners, our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Marshfield and now and talk with Francine. Hi, Francine. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My story relates to the most other stories. I probably realized around 7 that something was amiss with me. I'm a trans woman now. I moved to Vermont. One of the primary reasons was to transition. And I've lived in Morrisville since 2005 and have had virtually no difficulties in Morrisville or in Chittenden County or in Washington County throughout the years. And I've been very open about the fact that, I'm transgender. So I've been amazed at how wonderful the reception is and how much progress is made throughout the years.
Oh, that's great news. Thanks for sharing that, Francine. I appreciate that. It's kind of nice to hear that across in smaller towns, too, there's a good attitude, a welcoming attitude. Let's take another caller now from Brattleboro. Let's chat with Alex. Hi, Alex. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. And so I'm down in Brattleboro, and I just kind of wanted to chime into what Xander was alluding to in terms of resources outside of Chittenden County. And I am on the board of Green Mountain Crossroads, which is an LGBTQ rural organization based down in Brattleboro that is primarily focused on southern Vermont. And one of the things that, you know, we've been doing is creating spaces for folks to come to. And I think for me, as a gender nonconforming person, it's really awesome to have places where I can feel safe in my gender and feel supported and seen for that. And that is something that I think really helps create change in a social and sort of eventually, you know, larger legislative or institutional way.
Absolutely. Alex, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. I think many people wonder where to get help. They can probably find information online. Gabriella, in a town like Rutland, where you are from, mm-hmm. The area where I live, mm-hmm. where did you find help? Are there support groups in that part of the state?
Well, the beginning of the support, I did come up to Burlington. So Burlington, I will give you that. It has in that area. But after I sort of figured out what I needed to do, I have to tell you that I'm a member of the Congregational Church in Rutland. And I just want to share that I've just been amazingly embraced there. I was asked by the pastors to tell my story in a sermon one day a couple years ago and received a standing ovation at the end. So, and then just really quickly, I just think that rural Vermont can have acceptance. I work in a school, and just briefly, I'll tell you that I was so worried I was going to lose my work, you know, and met the principal one day, and the principal in this independent school in the Upper Valley said to me, "Gabby, are you worried you're going to lose your job?" Well, he said, "Don't be silly. You know, you do a great job. Why would we do that?" So, I really do think. I think part of that comes, at least from my generation, comes from sort of my attitude towards it and my acceptance. Because for me, unlike many younger, I hear the stories of younger, my own self-acceptance was actually some of my impeding stops along the way. So I was thrilled to have those levels of acceptance. And I live actually in Wallingford, and I have been absolutely accepted there. There's really not a question. I haven't ever had any backlash from being – I love living in Vermont. And I – one more quick point. Many friends when I was younger, when I was 600's age, would say, go to a bigger place, you know? And I didn't want to do that. I really loved living in Vermont. And I think that I think as more and more people choose to stay and be open and authentic in Vermont, I think all of those transitions are going to be easier.
What I'd be curious, what advice both of you, Xander, maybe I'll start with you. What advice do you have for young people, maybe even adults that you come in contact with who are conflicted, maybe struggling with gender identity and wondering what the first step might be for them, how would you advise them?
I think my piece of advice would be to find other people to find support in, whether it's other trans people through social support groups in your area or online, finding people you can talk to about experiences and narratives. I think I want to come back to the idea that no trans person narrative looks alike. It's all different. We all have different stories. And I think being able to find all of those different stories and place yourself in them is very important. So I would encourage people to look out into the world to find stories through support groups, through books, through the internet. I think that it's important to be able to make sense of yourself in the world. And one way to do that is through other people's stories. I think also validating yourself is really important. I think I spent a lot of time wondering, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with me. I don't know what's going on. And as soon as I sat down and validated my experience and said, this is painful because I'm struggling with my gender and that's okay. It's okay to be in pain because of this, was one of this sort of turning points in my sort of coming to be the person I am today is validating my own pain, because it's important to realize that it is a struggle, even if it's all internal, even if you have a supportive family, it is still a struggle. It's still traumatic for some people. And so I think it's important to do all of that internal validation of yourself.
Gabrielle, and
it's important to remember for folks who are just hearing about being transgender, that gay and lesbian and queer and all of those are really, they're all the letters are in the same acronym, but all of those things have to do with sexual identity. They have to do with who you maybe want to sleep with, is how I often say it in my talks. When you are transgender, it's how you want to sleep as. They're not related. And it is, you heard Caitlyn Jenner say that, and I will just emphasize that. Another point I want to really emphasize is everybody's story is different. And so to lump folks is really, really detrimental to people. You've really got to listen to their story, and you've really got to not judge a whole group of people by any one thing, because it's just not that way.
But I want to go back to something you both have touched on. I think a lot of people are confused about gender versus sexuality, and if you change your gender, does that change your sexuality? You alluded to comments made by Caitlyn Jenner in her now famous mm-hmm. interview where she said, no, they're separate. And you're both nodding your heads
They're separate. They're not related. Lots of people. I remember when one person first heard about it from my past, and this person said, oh, the rumor back to me was, oh, well, he must like boys now, you know? They're simply not related. You know, they're just not. And it doesn't mean, and I don't know how else to say it. They're just simply not. There's no connection. Everybody thinks that, but when you are transgender, they are not.
Sandra, did you want to add something?
Yeah, what I was going to say was, I mean, I identify as a queer trans person, and so my sexuality I label as queer, and my gender I label as trans, and I know plenty of trans people who identify as gay or lesbian or straight. I think that sexuality can sometimes play a role with your gender identity, but it is about your choice of who you want to spend time with or in romantic partnership or physically. And so I think that is something to be separate.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about being transgender in Vermont. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Lori Ann posted, my 6-year-old granddaughter has said she wants to be and actually is a boy for a few years now. In the last few months, she's dressed in boy clothes and has very short haircut and is often referred to as a boy by strangers. This makes her happy. She has a history of behavior issues in the classroom, and we notice that the more she is able to identify as a boy, the more cooperative she is. All of our family are very supportive, and we love her, whatever her gender, but we just don't know how to proceed from here. She's so young. Some people say that it is just a quote-unquote phase of being a tomboy, and lots of girls go through this. I'm sure there are a lot of parents in the situation wondering what they should do. Probably we need Dr. Rachel Inker back on the air to answer this question. This is more of a medical question. But do either of you have any suggestions for this family just to, how to proceed, Xander?
I'll put a plug in for Outright Vermont. Outright Vermont has a group that meets monthly of that's gender creative kids. So it's kids under the age of 12 who meet, and it's the parents or caretakers of very young children who are gender variant or gender creative. And the group has all ages of people and who identify themselves in all different ways. And the meeting space moves, but I would recommend that person give a call to Outright Vermont to just ask about what resources exist, just because the group does exist.
Gabrielle, I have a question just that I'd like to ask you that I haven't gotten to since you have lived so long as a man and now you're living as a woman. Yeah. And one thing I'm kind of curious about, that's a situation most of us don't have. What sort of perception have you had from society that's maybe surprised you, being a man versus being a woman, and how society
Oh, are you kidding? Oh, I have a story for you. Wait, you know, you in the introduction you started with that I teach people to drive. So I drive a lot, and I buy a lot of cars. And so sort of one of my favorite stories to tell when I make presentations is about buying a car as a man and then buying one a couple years later as a woman, I just was blown away. I remember walking out of the dealer and thinking, oh my God, I think I just took a stupid pill. I just couldn't understand why this person would speak. First of all, I probably knew more about cars than this person did, so it was really a foolish thing to do. I never bought a car from him just to let people know. But everybody has different gifts and things, individual story. I'm very blessed by being only 5 feet tall, and I don't have an Adam's apple, and this is all my own hair. And so I've easily transitioned and passed. I think it's the perception of actually, all my female friends would say that I have just had a wonderful gift because I've been able to experience life in both genders. So.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Listeners, this conversation will continue online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Xander Long and Gabrielle Annetsch, I want to thank you both very, very much for being on the show today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Nina.
Gabrielle Annetsch is a former teacher and principal from Rutland. She now owns a business, as she said, teaching people how to drive. Xander Long just graduated from Burlington High School. He's been involved in queer and trans advocacy and education in schools throughout Vermont. Xander's also worked as a youth board member, peer educator, and facilitator at Outright Vermont, and he'll attend Harvard this fall. Still to come, what the state is doing to protect its endangered plants and animals. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, sitting in for Jane Lindholm. Vermont has recently added 9 species to the state's threatened and endangered list. 3 different types of bumblebees, the fowler's toad, the rusty blackbird, and 4 plants. In total, Vermont lists 51 animals that are threatened or endangered animals and 163 plants. We have a link to all those protected species at vpr.net if you'd like to look at them in more detail. The endangered and threatened lists gives protection to the species and their habitat, but not without controversy. Hilary Hoffman is professor in the Vermont Law School's Environmental Law Center, and she joins us now to talk about how the Endangered Species Acts work. Professor Hoffman, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. Thanks for having me on the show.
So there are actually 2 Endangered Species Acts that apply in Vermont. There's the federal law and the state law, and we'll get to the reason for the 2 laws in a moment. But let's start with the federal law. What does it prohibit?
Federal law forbids anyone to take an endangered or threatened species, which includes pursuing, shooting, capturing, pulling up a plant. For example, that would fall under the definition, harassing animal species or attempting to do any of those things. And it also includes damaging or destroying the habitat of a listed species.
Well, I'm curious, how do you find out about that? Do people call in and,
No. Usually the agency will notify the landowner that there's a species, or sometimes the landowner will apply for a permit from a state or a federal agency, and then the agency will let the landowner know that the species exists.
I just was wondering about neighbors kind of ratting out the other neighbors saying, you know, somebody pulled up this or that. So how do species get on this list? Is it a purely scientific process?
Well, it's a lengthy procedural process, and federal law states that anyone can petition the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the agency primarily responsible for listing endangered or threatened species, and ask for a species to be listed. When the agency receives one of those petitions, it has about 90 days to decide whether the petition has merit, and if so, the agency has 1 year to consider all of that scientific evidence to make the formal decision about whether to add the species to the list.
And that's where the state law comes in then?
Under state law, it's a similar process, so that anyone can petition the state agency to list the species, but the determination would be made based on whether the species is threatened or endangered just within the state borders.
So the 9 species I mentioned that are listed under the Vermont Endangered Species Act, the federal program doesn't list them as endangered or threatened. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And why would a state be able to say that these species need protection but the federal government disagrees?
Well, it's not necessarily that there's disagreement. It's just that the state has identified these species as being as falling below the threshold within the state's borders. So it could be that there are higher numbers of the species in other states, and that's why the federal agency hasn't acted, or it could just be that the species is not one of the species that the federal agency considers to be a priority species.
Sure, sure. What are some of the differences between Vermont's Endangered Species Act and the federal statute when it comes to, say, habitat?
Yes. The focus of the federal law and Vermont's law are slightly different with respect to habitat. So under federal law, once a species has been listed, the agency is required to designate what's called critical habitat within 1 year, and that's defined as areas within the species' greater range or habitat that contain essential physical or biological features. That's what the statute says for the species' survival. So those are sort of like mating areas, spawning grounds, and areas like that. Under Vermont law, there's a broader definition. So the act prohibits all habitat destruction, and there's no delineation about critical habitat.
Huh. So the general habitat difference between the very important habitat, there's no distinction.
That's right, under Vermont law.
Huh. So what happens, say, if you find that you've got tulip tree or green mountain quillwort, those are the two, I believe, that are recently added to the list, on your property? What can you do and what can't you do according to the law?
Well, that will usually be up to the agency. So if there's something that you're doing that's threatening those species, the agency will usually let you know. Otherwise, agencies actually keep the location of species and habitat confidential, and they're required to by statute, and that's to prevent people from going out and poaching or deliberately targeting species. So you might not know that you have an endangered species on your property unless you're doing something that threatens that species.
I would think that would be the norm not to know. I mean...
Yes, that's correct, yes. unless you're a scientist, you have some specialized knowledge.
So does either law require that you report these plants or animals if you find them on your property? If you know, is there a statute that says you need to, if you recognize them?
No, there's absolutely no requirement under federal or state law that you report the discovery of a species. But I think that either the federal or state agencies would appreciate it if you did.
Sure.
If you knew that you had encountered an endangered species, I'm sure they would appreciate a friendly call letting them know that you had spotted the species and where, but there's no requirement.
How does Vermont deal with farmers? You know, they've got so much larger tracts, bigger properties that they're using. Do farmers fall under special rules regarding these state laws?
Yes, there's an exception under Vermont law for farming and logging activity, actually, and some would say that that exception almost swallows the statute because the state is prohibited from taking any action that would have a substantial impact on farming and logging activities. And so it's been the practice of the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources to let farming and logging activities occur even when there are endangered and threatened species. And it's required, the agency is required to under the statute.
Has there been any pushback on that? Are there critics that feel that that's not a good idea?
Yes, there has. As far as formally, I'm not sure about that, but there's definitely been scholarly criticism of the statute for having such a large exception. The federal law does not contain an exception like that. And under federal law, you're actually required to apply for a permit to continue any activity that would endanger a species or its habitat.
If you're found to be flouting the state or federal law, building on a site that's deemed critical habitat, say, what kind of penalties can you face?
The penalty provisions are between $500 and $1,000 under both laws, and I think Vermont's is actually the $1,000 and federal is $500. But under federal law, people should be aware that intentional trafficking in endangered species can be punishable by a fine of up to $25,000 per violation.
You've called the Federal Endangered Species Act one of the most powerful federal laws for its ability to bring development and construction projects to a halt when a species is discovered. That's not a good thing in everyone's mind, though.
No, it's not. And in Vermont, there have been several developments that people have probably heard about, such as a housing development in Williston near Taft Corners and a snowmaking pond at Killington that have been sort of large-scale controversies involving endangered species. But both of those projects actually proceeded. It was just there was some delay required because of the presence of the species to determine how to mitigate the habitat loss. So on the whole, development usually tends to occur despite the existence of the species as long as the landowner can demonstrate habitat mitigation. So environmentalists would say that's a flaw in the statute. And then developers would also criticize it, too, because it usually results in delay and additional expense.
And briefly, as a final question, how does Vermont's endangered law stack up to other states?
Well, Vermont is one of the states that has an endangered species law, so that puts it ahead of several states, and it's joined by New Hampshire and Maine. So actually, there's a lot of protection for endangered species in the New England area. And many of the states that have these laws have, the agriculture states have similar exceptions, and they tend to mirror the federal law. So these states usually adopt their environmental protection acts in line with the federal statute.
Professor Hillary Hoffman teaches natural resources law, administrative law, and Native American law at the Vermont Law School. Professor Hoffman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow on the program, baseball's All-Star break is almost upon us. So tomorrow we check in on how the season is progressing for your favorite teams. We'll see if the Red Sox have enough pitching and if they can survive the raft of injuries they've encountered and if the Yankees can hold to the top spot in the AL East. Send your questions or comments about the 2015 baseball season to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.